You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Most predictions are that the impasse in Washington will not be resolved anytime soon, and the White House Budget Office has issued an order to begin closing non-essential services, sending 800,000 federal workers on furlough while requiring hundreds of thousands of other employees to report for work without the guarantee of a paycheck. This extreme partisan gridlock has become a common feature of our political landscape, but as Chris Matthews, the host of MSNBC's Hardball, points out in his latest book, it was not always the case. In Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked, Mr. Matthews describes how President Ronald Reagan and Speaker of the House Thomas P. O'Neill Jr. were able to work together despite great differences in ideology. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings Chris Matthews back to our show today. Hi.
Thanks, Leonard.
During the early 1980s, you worked as a top aide for Tip O'Neill, so you were able to be a personal witness to what you've described in this book?
Yeah, I lived it, and I had my wife on last night to talk about it. She didn't get into it, the details, but the tenseness of those times and to being on the liberal side when it wasn't the popular side and dealing with a speaker who at the age of about 70 had to take on his greatest challenge. Every day, every hour was tense city, and I would, to keep my sanity, I would keep this ledger, you know, in this old-time business ledger, just to say, here's what we're going to try to do today. This is how bad today was. Tip's mad at me again. We got to try something tomorrow. And it really was living politics.
Although he was going up against somebody who was as old as he was or older, wasn't
it? In better shape. Much better shape.
Wouldn't being there color your opinion of how politics worked back then?
Well, I saw it work because, you know, when I was going to first write this book, I wanted to call it Donnybrook because it was about two Irish pals who fought it out in the back room when no one was listening. And then I began to develop this idea over the years of after the fight, they always found a way, as we say now at the end of the day, the new phrase, like spot on, we use those British terms, to get it done. And this was true of the big tax issue of 1982, the Social Security issue, and really salvation of Social Security in 83, the tax reform bill of 85, Northern Ireland, and even in his subordinate role in helping Reagan with the talks with Gorbachev. And all through those eras, they had a big fight. Now, there were some fights they never resolved, except I think Tip deserves credit for holding Reagan back, reining him in on Nicaragua. I think Tip always thought he wanted to get in there. And he said, that's going to be Vietnam all over again. And I think he really did constrain him. And that's, by the way, the irony. Tip helped stop Reagan from being a radical president and made him a conservative president.
Well, you worked on both sides of this divide because earlier you'd been with Jimmy Carter. But let's go
that
back.
That didn't mean the personality divide.
No. Well, also, you were in the White House and then you were in Congress.
Right.
You had been in the Peace Corps. For 2 years in Swaziland.
Yeah, it was a great place to be.
You were a trade development advisor. Did you know much about trade development?
Well, I'd been in a PhD program at Chapel Hill, and I'd done really well, an NDA fellowship, and I had good grades. But I wanted to do something practical, and I went over there and worked in economic development. I had a motorcycle, and I went around to small business guys who were about 50-some years old. And worked with them on their businesses. And then we did big trade shows and stuff like that. I mean, I did enjoy it immensely. And I got to travel, hitchhike through Africa. In fact, there's a moment in the book where I talk about being on the Rhodesian Railway in the middle of the night in a car by myself reading Kennedy by Ted Sorensen.
Is that what got you interested in politics?
I was interested in politics, Leonard, from the time I was five. I'm not going to give it credit to anybody. I remember our whole family was rooting for Ike. Like a lot of people, they were for Ike, and I was rooting for him. I remember all that.
A lot of people switched parties somewhere around that time.
I moved from Republican to very much like Hillary Clinton. It's very funny because Hillary went from—
She was Goldwater supporter.
She was Goldwater girl. In other words, she had the sash and everything. Goldwater was immensely— attractive to young people those days because he was a libertarian, like, leave me alone, let me live my life. And that's always going to have appeal in this country. And he was sort of a kind of a guy who later in life became very pro marriage equality. And he had a very liberal attitude about his life, I think it's fair to say. And then, of course, when Gene McCarthy came along, we were just wowed by him. He was an academic figure. He was ironic, poetic, and deep. And he didn't seem like a politician like Humphrey. He didn't seem like a guy who backslapped. And I think we, Hillary and I, both a bit different in age, but just absolutely wowed by him.
Well, you went to Washington after you left the Peace Corps. Was it easy to get a job?
No, it's always hard with no connections. I knew one guy that worked on the elevators and another guy that worked in an office. And what I did was, in those days before 9/11, it was an open building. You could actually go in without a lot of metal detectors or approval. And you could actually walk around from congressperson to congressperson to senator, leaving your resume off at the front desk and hoping you could get an interview with the AA. And hoping you could go from there to maybe being considered. And so I went through the whole route. I started, I have to admit, with the Irish guys from the Northeast, who I thought would be most impressed by the Peace Corps and Holy Cross, where I went to college. That didn't work, and I ended up getting a job from a Mormon out in Utah, the last liberal senator, Frank Moss.
He was called a moderate Democrat, actually, although he was more liberal than his constituents back home in Utah. How was he able to keep them voting for him? He was a three-term senator.
Well, he was a Mormon, and that helped, LDS. And he was a very good guy at getting government aid and protecting the wildlands out there in the national parks. I think the secret was he was lucky. It was a three-way race because Watkins, who had led the McCarthy investigation, Arthur Watkins, was running. And then there was a right-winger running to his right, and he came right down the middle like Woodrow Wilson did, right down the middle. And then, of course, in 70... the townhouse campaign by Nixon got so crazy out of whack by the radicalism of Agnew and the rest of them. He won then.
Did he vote in a way that could keep the people
home
satisfied?
No, I think he was a liberal. He was voting with Muskie, basically. Muskie and he were very connected, those guys.
And then,
he got me a job with Muskie on the budget committee later on. Yeah.
But you also moonlighted as a policeman.
That was the deal. The deal in those days, and Mike Barnicle did this and Harry Reid did this, you'd work for a senator in the daytime, and at night they'd put you out on patrol with a uniform and a .38. You'd totally ridiculous that I had a .38 special in my pocket. And you'd be doing duty. What I did with those jobs is mainly read in the middle, in the bottom of the Capitol, and some basement hallway. I'd sit there reading the congressional record, trying to learn how to write a congressional speech, which is what I did.
But you also stood watch on the office where the Pentagon papers were being held.
Did I put in the book that they had already been published? But I'm guarding this, and Bobby Byrd is watching me do that. I'm up there with a gun and everything, and somebody told me there's something called the Pentagon Papers in this room, and don't let anybody in. It was one of those weird introductions to Washington. The Pentagon Papers, of course, were published both by Katharine Graham and the New York Times, and they got out, of course, and I'm glad we got them. But my job was to make sure nobody got them.
Well, Harry Reid is a former boxer. How tough were you?
No, I was a minimally successful as a police officer. My biggest worry looking back was I nuts enough to walk across Pennsylvania Avenue, which was a high-crime area, carrying a gun? If there had been a holdup somewhere, they would have come to me, and I'd have to shoot it out with some guy. And I was just a patronage cop. But I did learn a lot. And the nice thing about that job, and I've always tried to turn jobs into something, I met a lot of West Virginia guys and working guys who had been MPs in the military, double dippers. And I read about Leroy Taylor in there. He's sort of a regular Southern guy who said to me, you know why the little man, we became fond of each other. He said, you know why the little man loves his country? And I don't know. He says, because it's always God. And you talk about profundities. He doesn't have a big house or a big job, or he's not in any way celebrated. He doesn't have things, but he's got his nation. And it's such a powerful message, and I think it explains so much that a lot of sophisticated people don't get about love of country. It's the one claim you have.
You ran for political office after you left Senator Moss and lost.
I ran as the reformer in a Democratic district against an incumbent, and I had some corruption on him, and I made him pay for it. He got beaten. He ended up being indicted and quitting politics. But it was a great experience. I had 400 kids working for me. I didn't have any money. I went around from high school to high school asking the principal if I could speak there, and I had a couple people who were in the way going into the Peace Corps who set them up, and Marilyn Funk, in fact, and her husband. And they set it up for me, and these kids really volunteered. My press secretary volunteered. We didn't have any money. In fact, one time I bought pizza for the kids, and they got mad at me. They wanted to be complete a band that was playing for me at the shopping malls, and they said, why are you buying us pizza? People were so pure in my campaign. It was heartening.
My guest is Chris Matthews. His latest book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. We'll get to Tip and the Gipper in just a moment, but we're moving along. You worked for Jimmy Carter. That was kept on moving up the ladder, didn't you?
It's serendipity. I was working briefly in a Brooklyn campaign, and I met a fellow named Bob Schiffer, who was a friend of mine for life, and he introduced me to Rick Hertzberg, who became the chief speechwriter, and we became
now
friends.
Now with the New Yorker.
Yeah, he's with the New Yorker. Beautiful writer. And I recommended one guy to be a speechwriter when a vacancy occurred, and then I said, well, how about me this time? And this is ironic. The Democratic Party, for some reason, had a lot of Jewish people who were in the office writing speeches and a lot of Protestants. But there were no Catholics in the office. And so the Catholic Charity speech was coming up, and they needed somebody to write the Catholic Charity speech, and that was my tryout. I did the tryout, and I got the job.
Before the 1980 election, what did people in the Carter administration think of Ronald Reagan? Did they consider him a serious threat?
Well, maybe the real pals knew he was a threat because he had beaten the odds so many times before. But I would say among the intellectual policy people that worked for Stu Eisenstadt, and those kind of people with the really good Ivy League educations, I think they looked down on him. I think they thought he was a Hollywood guy, a lightweight BS artist, if you will. But the one great moment I do talk about it or write about it, is when Pat Brown, who had been beaten by him, a good guy, Pat Brown, and very likable. He had beaten Nixon by a quarter million in 62. He got beaten by Reagan in 66, and he came around to warn Jerry Rapshaw, my good friend, the head of communications for Carter, this guy, you're going to accuse him of being lazy, you're going to accuse him of being too right-wing and whatever, and it's not going to work. None of it's going to work. Nothing sticks to Reagan, and that should have been a pretty good warning.
And then he won the election by a landslide, 489 electoral votes to 49.
And we knew that in the middle of the night.
Carter made his speech in which he said that he admitted that he was going to win this time before the West Coast votes.
It was a bad move. We got the call around 1 o'clock in the morning coming out, or maybe we're closer to midnight, coming out of Seattle, our last speech, and all of us thought it was the best speech Carter had ever given. In fact, Hertzberg said to Carter when he came back for drinks with us, which was unusual, you got, Mr. President, you finally got your stump speech down. And Carter laughed because he really was proud of how well he had done. But by then we get the call from Pat Kiddell, our pollster, we're going to lose by 10.
Do you think that he was unfairly blamed for problems that had been developing for years? Of course, he was to some degree responsible for the problem in Iran because he allowed the Shah to come to this country.
Yeah.
And that led to the hostage crisis.
Yeah, Kissinger pushed that. David Rockefeller pushed that, and he gave into that. And that may have been humanitarian on his part. I don't know. It was not knowing that the Iranian government, as it was at the time, would buckle to the students, that they would just let the students take over. It was just a lack of knowledge. And he did pay for that. I think Iran became the symbol of his weakness, and it killed us.
In order to achieve this landslide victory, Reagan had to get an awful lot of registered Democrats to vote for him. How did he do that? Do you think they were just disillusioned with Carter?
I think they wanted to feel good again. Americans want to feel good. Mary McCarthy said the happy ending is the American dream, the American notion. We like the happy ending. I remember I talk about this. I was walking through Georgetown with my wife Kathleen one afternoon. It was Labor Day itself. And I had written Carter's big kickoff speech. And I wanted to see how it went. So I went into the third edition, which is a college bar along Wisconsin Avenue. And I wanted to see how it played on the evening news. And what shocked me was not so much Carter's speech, but Reagan's. There he was standing in Jersey overlooking the Statue of Liberty with the Statue of Liberty's back, giving this heroic nationalistic speech. Oh, my God, I said, this is new. This is before Lee Iacocca rediscovered the Statue of Liberty, and it was just this icon that had been laid to rest, and he brought it back alive, and I said, my God, this guy is doing something here with the ethnic people, the working Irish, Italian, Jewish, Polish, the regular people, middle, who had been voting Democrat but had been very dismayed by Carter's inability to stand up for the country. And Reagan was grabbing that torch. The Gipper, the hero of Notre Dame, in fact, was coming back and reclaiming that territory. And he did it right through the campaign.
There's also runaway inflation at the time.
Yes.
Ronald Reagan claimed that in his campaign that he would balance the federal budget while at the same time cutting taxes, increasing military spending. George Bush called it voodoo economics. But do you think the public bought it?
They wanted to buy it. They knew They knew they needed something different, and they weren't doing the arithmetic. And I guess what they heard was growth, hope, a bright future. They didn't do the obvious math of raising defense, cutting domestic spending somewhat, but then a huge tax cut, 25%, was going to mean deficits.
My guest is Chris Matthews. His latest book, this is catching, Chris, is called Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. It is published by Simon & Schuster, and we'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in the show, baritone Mariusz Kwieciń talks about singing the title role in the Metropolitan Opera's production of Eugene Onegin. Plus, David Finkel shares stories of what happened to the members of a battalion he'd been embedded with in Iraq after they returned home. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.
WNYC is supported by The Penguin Press, publisher of Bleeding Edge, the new novel from Thomas Pynchon, set in New York City in 2001 in the lull between the collapse of the dot-com boom and September 11th. Available now. Twelfth Night and Richard III, in repertory on Broadway for 16 weeks. Mark Rylance appears in both plays and Stephen Fry appears in Twelfth Night. Performances feature original Elizabethan staging, including onstage seating. Previews begin October 15th. ShakespeareBroadway.com. WNYC is giving away 65 pairs of tickets to see the film The Fifth Estate, presented by the Walt Disney Studios at AMC Lincoln Square on Tuesday, October 8th at 7. Enter to win. Click on giveaways at WNYC.org by 11 p.m. and follow the instructions.
Hello, I'm Sotirios Johnson. Now you can start your day with WNYC's Morning Brief, a daily email that delivers headlines and top stories from the WNYC newsroom, plus weather, interactive web features, noteworthy shows you might have missed, and news of exciting WNYC events. Sign up now for Morning Brief on the homepage at WNYC.org.
We're back with Chris Matthews. His latest book, Tip and the Gipper, is published by Simon & Schuster. So your job at MSNBC doesn't take up enough of your time? You can write books on the side?
I'm a crazy person. My wife calls it that chair, which is where I go in our office at home, my office I have, which is an old bedroom. And every morning at 6, every night, every weekend. I mean, I hope this book gets to enough people because it has not been a plus at home.
Well, after President Carter's defeat, you began working for Tip O'Neill. Was that just a natural move?
Not at all. Marty Franks, who's a friend of mine, was our research guy, a young guy. He gets a job working as the campaign committee director, executive director for the House. And he and his boss, Tony Coelho, a congressman from California, decide, along with Kirk O'Donnell and some people in the speaker's office, that Tip O'Neill, who's got the last platform in the Democratic Party, the Democrats lost the Senate, lost the presidency, and lost 33 seats in the House in the Reagan landslide, all they had left was Tip O'Neill. And every morning he gave a press conference for 15 minutes. And he wasn't really using it for anything more than business. Just, here, we're doing this, we're doing this. And they had the idea that Tip could become a spokesman for the Democratic Party, in fact, the leader of the Democratic Party. And they brought me in on the side. I didn't want to go in because I had this great resume, presidential speechwriter. But I went in, and after about 3 or 4 months, Tip got used to me. We had the assassination attempt, and then he started to use my lines. He called me his writer, and eventually he started to really embrace me, and it blew me away. He made me his top guy. So,
but did you see working for him as a second chance to get back at Reagan?
Yeah, how'd you know? In fact, I thought for 2 years how to get back, because the networks, I was mad at them. The commercial networks, CBS, had ended. Begun its coverage, the evening news with Cronkite, the night before the election, leading with the fact it was the first year anniversary of the hostage taking. The second item of the news in the budget that night was the election the next day. Carter was screwed by that. I mean, it was like saying, this is more important, you got to be smart and vote against this guy. So 2 years later, when we did our work, the first item was Social Security and how the issue was working for the Democrats and against Reagan. He picked up 26 seats.
Now, he has often been called the great communicator. Tip O'Neill wasn't exactly a bad communicator.
He became a much better one. He was very good in small groups. He was really afraid of TV, and then he got into it. And then he became quite a figure.
Well, if you listen to Republicans today, Reagan was the greatest president since Abraham Lincoln. A number of Republicans in Congress have said that he would have been more forceful with Assad than Obama has been, despite the fact that he actually aided Saddam Hussein in using chemical weapons against Iran in the war that Saddam had started.
Yeah. Well, I'm not a Reagan fan, but I do think he became a major figure in our lives. And I think liberals have to explain that, accept that. Like, I always say that the smart politicians who are actually practicing politicians are very smart, like Clinton was, to recognize Reagan and the way Obama's recognized Reagan. And I think he'll end up in the top 12 or so. I think historians in the academic world won't like him, but I think the public will put him up there because he did do the steps to get us out of the Cold War. And he did take those steps with Gorbachev. But, you know, he had this ability. Tip called him the best platform speaker with a speech draft of anybody he had ever seen. When he could go on television, I was with him when he gave the Challenger speech that Peggy Noonan wrote that afternoon. And I guess I told him I thought that must be Peggy Noonan because it was unbelievable. And I read her column every week now. And he called her up the next day and congratulated her on the speech. We would do things in those days like Tip would know Mike Deaver and ask him for help. And I'd know Duberstein and ask him for help. And there was a real kind of a commonality to the right wing and the left wing in those days, the White House and the Speaker's office, that is gone today.
Well, was his popularity and influence on Democrats in Congress?
Yeah, because, see, Obama, the president, who I really support on policy, can't go into a Republican district today and cause trouble for the member. He just can't because of gerrymandering and a lot of things. We know the gerrymandering thing. But Reagan could cause trouble with a lot of Southern Democrats because they naturally were fiscally conservative and very patriotic and hawkish in many cases. So he could go to those days. These guys wanted to be with him. And there were a lot of moderate Democrats around the country who wanted to be with him. Because, look, he came back to most people, to most of us growing up, like you and I, we knew him as the host of GE Theater. He was a very affable, likable person. And then he had the movie history, The Gipper. He played the Notre Dame hero. People liked him.
But he had all sorts of proposals that didn't fly. He wanted to change the way Social Security was
sure
done.
Did. We caught him on that.
And you've said that that is a political third rail.
Third rail. We nailed him.
At the same time, it didn't seem to hurt him.
It hurt him in 62 and 82. He lost 26 seats. I think we really rammed him on that one. And
there's the taxation issue.
He raised taxes in 82. We got him to raise taxes by the largest tax increase to make up for his big tax cut of 81. He did do a really good tax reform bill, 28%. But imagine today a Republican saying, I want to equalize the tax rate for capital gains with earned income. That's remarkably progressive. And today there's always a big differential. You make more money off money than working every day. And I think the Social Security solution was a progressive solution. It was raising the taxes implicitly, a means test. The tip jammed through, and Reagan went along with. So Reagan, just like he was in California when he signed the most pro-choice bill in history out there, he was a compromiser in the end after he fought. And I think Tip was like that. Today, they just keep fighting.
My guest is Chris Matthews. His latest book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked, published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, after Reagan was inaugurated as president, he went to meet with Tip O'Neill. Can you describe what that first face-to-face meeting was like?
Well, they tried to be friends, and they talked about the Notre Dame movie because he had been the hero of that film. They had that in common. And then Tip caused a little trouble with Reagan and said, welcome to the big leagues. And that really bothered him.
Because he'd been kind of saying California was a minor league.
Yeah, because Reagan had fought it out with the Democrats and the legislature in Sacramento. He didn't like that. He'd also been elected president in 44 states, by 44 states. But they generally began this sort of affable relationship. Tip, the first thing he did after Reagan was inaugurated, had him sign all these first edition of stamps. Because Tip was a stamp collector. He gave them to his brother. So Reagan's standing there forever signing these things, saying every time he signed, well, that's another Democratic vote I'm going to get from you. And then, of course, he invited him down for his birthday party. They had dinner together. Reagan really warmed him up. And then, of course, the assassination attempt really existentially changed everything. The mood just changed. And nobody wanted to fight a guy who had survived a bullet that went right to his heart. And that's what really... I describe it in the book with Tip in the hospital room with Reagan, where he's the first guy allowed in to see him, and he's down on his knees and he's holding Reagan's hands and they're praying the 23rd Psalm together, and kiss the guy. I mean, there was a real moment there with these two old guys, and I don't know. You never know, because Tip never talked about this in the office. I had to find out this from a Reagan guy who happened to be there, and there was things that went on there between that relationship which are very complicated.
On the other hand, Tip accused Ronald Reagan of being out of touch with common Americans.
Yep, sure did.
And Reagan really was upset that he accused O'Neill of demagoguery.
He sure did.
They had a – well, then there was the whole matter of the – of the traffic traffic controllers organization being pretty much destroyed by Reagan, which upset all Democrats.
Not because, Tip. Tip may have he was pro-labor, of course, but he thought – see, what happened then was so complicated. Duane Andreas, head of Archer Daniels Midland, you know, communists like dealing with capitalists. They don't like liberals or socialists, but they love dealing with capitalists because they figure they're calling the shots. So when Duane Andreas goes over to Moscow and meets with the Soviet leadership, they tell him, we take this guy Reagan seriously because he broke a strike. Not only that, he put the word to everybody who walked out in that wildcat, you're never going to work for the government again because you broke not just your contract but your oaths. So they took him seriously. And when Tip went over to meet Gorbachev well before Reagan met him, first thing he said was, we have a common friend. So there was this weird sort of relationship, and that's when Tip vouched for Reagan and said, look, I disagree with the guy, but he's our leader, and you better deal with him.
There was irony in the fact that Patco had supported Ronald Reagan during the election.
I think the Democrats liked that.
Against Carter.
They liked that because this is what you get, as Tip said, for endorsing a Republican. But, you know, Tip was a student of Reagan, even though he disagreed with him and fought with him like you cannot believe every day. And thought in many ways he was a lightweight because he'd always come with the 3x5 cards and stuff and not really know the substance. He always studied a couple things about the guy, like the Patco strike and how it sent the word to the Soviets. He had to deal with this guy. His voice. It wasn't Reagan's looks. He said it was the voice. He said that cowboy voice of his. And I think it's so true when you think about the quality of his voice as a broadcaster and then later as a cowboy star was basically the same wonderful voice, like a Dean Martin voice. I remember going to the drive-in with my dad and you hear that voice like Dean Martin's crackling through the speaker. He had that quality to speak to the American people, and Tip knew what he was up against.
Dean Martin was from Ohio, as is John Boehner. John Boehner doesn't have that voice.
He's not of that cut.
No, but
I do feel sorry. You know who should play John Boehner, now we get into the movies, is Jack Lemmon. He should be like Save the Tiger.
If he were still alive.
Or even Glengarry Glenn Lewis, he could play Levine the Machine again. The guy that just is at the end of his line. You know, it isn't working. You know, that's what Boehner's like now.
The Patco strike is often cited as the beginning of the end for unions in America.
I hear that.
And ironic that Reagan had been a union leader.
It wasn't the beginning of the end of the union movement. The union movement's had problems for years with its gerontocracy and its old-style leadership. You need a young, mouthy guy to lead those unions one of these days. Jerry Wirth could have done it, or somebody like that. You got to get on television on Sunday, and you got to make your case, and they don't do it very well. SAG leader. He was elected all those years, 5 or 6 times. He was pretty good on the contract. The day they get residuals, at least from 60 on, from 1960 on, they never got residuals before. This is unbelievable, but people like Bing Crosby and the guys like Bob Hope never got and Cagney never got a nickel.
Now, SAG has merged with my union, AFTRA.
Yeah,
and has not done anything to help my career at all.
I pay about $28 a year for that. Not a lot of money, but.
In November 1981, there was that article by William Grider that ran Atlantic called The Education of David Stockman that also caused a big to-do. It's interesting that all of these things were seen as real problems for Reagan, and yet Reagan weathered them all.
Well, he had a lot of spin. I remember his cleverest move may have been when he gets caught, where his architect comes out and says, the house won't stand. The numbers don't add up. There's a magic asterisk here. It's all aimed at getting the top rate down. Everything else was a Trojan horse so that the rich could be better. All this on the record. The budget director to a respected journalist for the Post at the time, William Grider, and he wrote this for Rolling Stone. It's all on the record. Front page article in the magazine. And Reagan and his people just brilliantly said, this isn't about revelation. This is about treason. This young man has let us down. And all of a sudden, the press, and Sam Donaldson is usually pretty smart about this, completely fell in line like lemmings, and they said, oh, they got him. He's a treasonous little kid, and we're going to take him to the woodshed. What a joke. And the press completely fell for it and let Reagan play the judge Hardy, you know, the spanking the kid, you know.
Well, what was Tip O'Neill doing during all of this?
We were fighting
all that talk about trickle-down
Tip was
economics.
Tip was saying, David Stockman, I respect him. He's telling the truth. He's saying what I've been saying. He always said David Stockman was not a liar. He would tell the truth. And when he told the truth in that interview, he said, that's what I've been saying. In fact, Reagan said at the time, if this gets out, what you're saying, Tip O'Neill's going to have a halo around his head because this is what he's been saying.
Now, then the Iran-Contra came along.
Yeah.
At the end
of the long fight over Nicaragua, which is so interesting because Tip always said, this is Reagan's Vietnam. He wants to take us in down there. And then you get guys like Poindexter at the end who said, the reason I gave him the money, or didn't care about the diversion, is because we're so sick of Tip O'Neill holding up the money. And I'm very proud Tip held up the money, kept us out of that situation down there.
So how is that different from the situation today? Tip O'Neill was trying to hold the fort against Reagan in the same way that John Boehner is trying to hold the fort against Obama, at least for his party.
Well, I'm trying not to frown on radio, but the difference is huge. And here's the difference. And maybe it's like Barbara Tuchman wrote about World War I and how it started in the Guns of August, where both sides miscalculate. What I think, and this is partially Obama's fault, I have to admit, he doesn't instill fear in the hearts of his enemy, and therefore they feel they can do anything, anything. They can call him born in Kenya, Kenyan anti-British colonial thinking, horrible things. I had a guy on the show the other night who wouldn't admit he was legitimately elected. You can't talk about a president like that.
But they all deny that race is a factor in their attacks on him.
Well, obviously it is. But here's what I think. They have said, we want your baby. We want health care. We want to chop its legs off. Whatever we're going to do to this baby, we want it to be dismembered a year. We'll put it off a year. We're going to destroy it a year from now. They're making it very clear they're going after his major historic accomplishment for the Democratic Party after 50 years. And look what they're doing, this thing. He can't give on this. I don't think he will give. So what's going to happen?
But how come nobody's making the argument that so-called Romney Care in Massachusetts has been a big success? Everybody in the state loves it. It's pretty much the same program.
But Leonard, this morning we saw the run. There's like a bank run. Everybody wants to get into this system. It's like buying a new iPhone.
But if you speak to people in Congress, this one person said, this is the worst law in the history of the world.
Yeah,
I mean, we've had some pretty bad laws in the world.
Everybody wants to get in, I'll tell you. And that's what they're afraid of. And even we have them on record, by the way, Ted Cruz, who's the arch demon of this whole thing. Ted Cruz came out and said, by January, they're all going to be loving this thing. They'll be addicted to the sugar. Well, that's the truth.
Now, a lot of people are blaming Newt Gingrich for starting this partisan divide.
I do. I blame him. Because up until Gingrich started his sort of revolutionary politics under Tip, there was a relationship between Bob Michael or Gerald Ford and the Republican leader and the Democratic leaders in the Congress worked together. He came along and said, enough of this, get along to go along, we're not going to compromise anymore.
And he
shut down the government for a month.
And that made the Republican Party rather unpopular for a while. It started losing elections. Why is it different today? Because of gerrymandering?
Well, there's two reasons for this disproportionate recognition or representation by Republicans. And it's hard to disaggregate it, but basically it's this. In Pennsylvania, where I'm from, we have 13 Republican members of Congress, including all the suburbs, basically, except for Alison Schwartz, and we have 5 Democrats in the whole state of Pennsylvania, which regularly votes Democratic for president, and which 100,000 more people voted Democratic for Congress in 2012. But the way the districts are arrayed, all the Democrats are stuck in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and maybe up in Penn State. So they got 85% return for the Democrat in Bobby Brady's district and in Shaka Fatah's district. Out in California, in the Bay Area, same deal. Nancy Pelosi, Barbara Lee, huge super pluralities. But then you get into other districts and it's 52, 48, that kind of thing. I think that's part of it. But I do think they could make a lot more effort to reapportion the country so that you'd have something like the popular vote being represented.
Just one more question, Chris, before you go. Do you think that Tip O'Neill would be handling things differently if he were in Congress today?
He'd be representative of his caucus. Tip was Mr. Democrat, like Reagan was Mr. Republican. Boehner's got a real problem. He's an old-style Republican. He could have fit very well in the politics of 30 years ago. He's outlasted his time. He is now representing a bunch of right-wing revolutionaries who have nothing in common with him. I was at an event, by the way, with him when he referred to his rank and file in a way you can't say on television or radio. He doesn't think much of these right-wing guys at all. And this was a Catholic event, raising money or helping people get scholarships. He doesn't think much of these people, but he's got to represent them. Now, I want to know whether Cantor's behind him. Is McCarthy behind him? If he has to make a last stand 3 or 4 weeks from now over the debt, when it really gets scary, will he hold the leadership together? Will he hold the moderates together and the centrist conservatives against the crazies? I think that's going to be the most exciting moment in politics in a long time when that comes. And it has to come.
Chris Matthews is the host of MSNBC's Hardball and now the author of another book, his follow-up to Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. This one is called Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Worked. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us
It's always
again.
Great, Leonard. Thank you.